Welcome to the Blue Whale. Welcome to the Dark Shadows Daybook at night or in the pod or casting or whatever. I'm Patrick McCray, and I'm joined with the fabulous Dark Shadows journalist, analyst, reporter, recorder, reviewer, web mistress of Josette's Music Box, and writer for the Collinsport Historical Society, the fantastic Alexis Latcha. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I am. I'm fine as rugs here. And so the topic we've been given is that of Barnabas Collins, and what could be more quintessential to Dark Shadows than that? So I mentioned that to you earlier today. First blush thoughts.
That is a really big topic, first of all.
It is a big topic.
Barnabas is a little broad.
Yeah. Oh, he's a large Canadian man, but continue.
This is true. I mean, over 6 feet tall. You can't avoid that.
Okay. So, all right. So it's a little broad. When I mentioned the name Barnabas Collins, whether it's a visual or whether it's a word or whether it's a name or anything, what's the first thing that pops into your mind?
Byronic.
Byronic. Okay, as in Byron Allen, co-host of Real People? No, seriously. Tell me more about that.
The first thing, this was not a pre-planned statement, this was actually the first thing that popped into my head, was somewhat of a Byronic hero.
Okay.
That whole romantic, tortured, somewhat brooding and melancholic hero of the story.
But interesting that the word hero is what you went to.
I did.
Because a lot of people love to attach the word villain and go very dark when they talk about Barnabas. So let me ask you, why do you think they go there when they talk about him? I mean, I guess he murders people, so there is that, but...
I mean, to be fair, there is a body count, but... That doesn't negate the hero. I stand by the hero statement. I think a lot of people go to villain. Part of it may be because of the early establishment of the character.
Mm-hmm.
That very early intro to Barnabas, which is all sorts of fun.
It is.
But I personally don't believe it's the defining arc for his character. I think that's testing the waters, feeling it out, getting in there, then realizing that killing this character is a terrible life decision and not doing it, and writing the ship. So I think there is some impulse to use that early characterization as the basis of understanding his entire character.
Uh-huh.
But I also think he can be unfairly maligned by asking parts of the fandom.
Okay, tell me about that.
Well, for one thing, I do think part of it is that, and I do it as well, it's with love. But he does, you know, there's Jonathan Frid's endearing line read struggles.
Sure.
And his, which we all make fun of with love, but I do think there's some parts of the fandom that over time have come to view him as being, I'm trying to think of a way to put it. You see some aspects of the fandom that take a view of kind of the slightly inept, relying on Julia, not entirely the linchpin of the show character.
Mm-hmm.
I disagree with that.
So you do see him as the linchpin of the show.
I do,
sure,
in a lot of ways.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Dark Shadows is about Barnabas. Star Trek's about Captain Kirk. People may want to focus on Spock or something like that, even though his appearance on Dark Shadows is very brief. Nonetheless, the show is about William Shatner as Barnabas Collins. But all seriousness aside, the show really is about Barnabas and following his arc, and I feel like everything going up to it is just a prelude to set the stage for that, and everything that happens after Barnabas goes away is kind of a commentary on what's happened. And even the other characters who appear are either antagonists for Barnabas, or like Quentin, they're sort of reflector characters for Barnabas. There are similarities, but they almost exist to establish the character in a fuller and fuller sense.
I would agree with that. I think stripping the behind the curtain aspects of it, the things that we know about the showrunners and all of that outside, stripping all of that out of it, and instead looking at the show as a work unto itself, basically taking out all the trappings that we happen to know exist, which people at the time, when it was on the air to begin with, would not have had any reason to know existed. So we're stripping all that out, looking at the show just on its own. Within that story, there is this really, really nuanced, and when you get to the end of it, surprisingly sharply focused character arc in Barnabas Collins, which
very much so.
Rationally should not be the case, given what kind of show it is, but it's there.
Yes.
And that arc is what the rest of the show ultimately rests on. It's the underpinnings of everything that happens. Is he enters as this villain. I would make the case personally, this is my interpretation of that section of the show, that the reason he's such a villain is that he's been locked in a coffin for a very long time, and he's not entirely sure exactly what's going on.
Sure. We've talked about this.
We've talked about this, that it's, I mean, anyone would be struggling with this. He comes out of a coffin. His entire family, some people he doesn't like, all these people, they are basically all around him, but they have different names and different personalities. It's not beyond realistic to think that he's a little confused and maybe doesn't really think this is entirely real. You know, maybe he just finally snapped. He's gone crazy in the coffin.
Well, it's Angelique's, you know, sort of putting him in the Matrix and messing with him. Because then he sees his fiance, who died, but she's a barmaid. And so the story becomes Vertigo.
Yes, it does.
It becomes Vertigo. And he thinks that he can recreate her, or if not recreate her, if this really is Josette, he can release her. He's got this mouth-breathing Rube, who's his closest connection to humanity. And yet he keeps trying to betray him. You know, he was used to Ben Stokes. And he and Ben, for one thing, already had a history. So Ben was going to trust him. But also, Ben was just a more trustworthy type of unseemly criminal rather than Willie Loomis. But of course, Ben Stokes wasn't meant to have much of a character arc, and Willie Loomis does. Talk about a character who changes tremendously over the course of the show.
Oh, Willie has an incredible character arc. But that's its own topic. That is a whole other podcast episode.
It is. So when we look at this, for one thing, I think there's a right way and a wrong way to watch the series, and it doesn't necessarily involve sobriety, but I think it's, for me, it's much more interesting to watch the show from Barnabas's point of view and timeline rather than from Victoria's. So, if you start at the beginning of 1795 and go forward, and then, you know, and then when normally the 1795 story would happen, you just skip that, and you go to where they're back at the seance, suddenly you have a very different context for Barnabas, because you start the story with Barnabas as a human. And it's very easy then to see him as a better person, and to see what he's capable of. I really like that personally. That was specifically, I watched the show in 2013, and it worked extremely well. I came up with some statistics that also clarify the show. I did. I'm big on statistics. I'm big on numbers.
I like it.
And so here we are. Some things to think about. In looking at Barnabas, hero or villain, and I say hero, I say one of TV's great heroes, maybe one of literature's great heroes, I'm very big on that. And I think that darn movie, that House of Dark Shadows, which a lot of people like, and that's terrific.
You mean the greatest film Hammer didn't make?
I don't know if it was the greatest film Hammer didn't make.
I love that film, but I love that film as sort of a knockoff Hammer horror and not as a piece of Dark Shadows canon.
Well, it's not. I mean, it's a strange movie.
It's a very strange movie.
In the documentary they made, one of the writers went up to Dan Curtis and said, "Why is Barnabas such a jerk in this? You know, why is he killing people?" I thought, you know, Barnabas had kind of moved beyond that to, you know, the Barnabas everyone loved that had kept the show going for years. And Dan just looked at him and said, "No, we're not making that kind of movie." And
that movie also has some spectacular Day for Night.
Dan Curtis is a big Day for Night fan.
it's in the 90s revival, some beautiful Day for Night. He was a big Day for Night guy.
Dan liked to save money. But if we look at the breakdown of because my House of Dark Shadows experience is a whole separate thing. If we look at the breakdown of sort of good versus evil on the show, it's interesting because according to my inaccurate count, he spends about 15 months of the show as what we would call evil. He spends about 29 months of the show as what we would call good. Within that, he is a vampire for about 31 months. And then within that, he is human for about 13 months. But I think the important number here to look at is that 29 months that he spends as essentially a good person, as opposed to 15 months of evil, which would be when we first meet him, even though it's a very conflicted evil, it's when we first meet him. And then I count 1795. I went ahead and counted that in the evil era, just for the hell of it. And then the beginning of the Leviathan arc.
Yes.
So I put that. I lump those into his times of naughtiness, but the rest of it, he's a hero. So for 29 months of his stint on the show, that's a long time.
It is, and I also, I mean, I feel like maybe with 1795 we could grant some extenuating circumstances.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean,
I would grant extenuating circumstances. He's been through some trauma. It's been a bad time, you know.
Well, that increases his era of general goodness. I mean, that
I would, because I feel like the end of 1795, I mean, he didn't even know vampires existed.
And
now he is.
Yeah, they were loath to use the word, and
I believe it's somewhere in the early beginnings of the 400s, 402, 405, something like that. I think is where they first used that word.
He's dropping off dead prostitutes in the rooms of his ecclesiastical enemies. He's doing good stuff. What era of the show was going on when you first started watching it?
Oh, that is, I couldn't even tell you off the top of my head. The first time I saw the show was in Sci-Fi Channel syndication in the 90s.
Okay.
And so, I started watching actually because my mother was a fan of the show and it was on the air the first time, and she was watching it in syndication. She hadn't seen it since it had been on the air originally. So I didn't start watching it immediately. Somehow along the way, because my mom was watching it all the time, I started watching it with her. It probably was, honestly, it might have been around 1795.
Okay.
When I first, the very first time, which that's a part of the show that I'm very well versed in because I've probably seen it more times in its completion.
So
I'm not sure why that is, because it's actually not my favorite arc in the show.
Sure, sure. So here's a question then, based on that. Do you think when people begin the show, do you think where Barnabas is in his life, do you think that affects their reading of the show from that point forward, or do you think it's more flexible than that?
It probably does, just in that way that our first impression of anything can color it.
Mm-hmm.
However, that being said, I do think that your initial impression of something can be overcome. It may not need to be overcome. Overcome is the best word I've got for it. With a close read of the material. Mm-hmm. Like, your opinion about Barnabas, if you start watching the show right when he comes in the first time, he's evil, he's picking people off, he's beating Willie, it's, you know, all sorts of fun stuff's going on at Colin's Court. You start watching there, and your first impression is evil, villain, bad. Mm-hmm. And you may stick with that. That may stay with you, and you may never really see him as redeemable. And some people don't. You know, he's killed a bunch of people. Maybe he's not redeemable. I don't know that you're necessarily stuck with that if you then go back and give the whole story more of a close read, and you really look at it, and you really track the arc. Which can be hard to do if you've seen the show stretched out over a very, very long period of time as it was initially aired. And I know some people do watch it that way, like one episode a day. Mm-hmm. I don't think I could do it. That's not how I consume this particular program. I consume it in very large chunks at a time.
Yeah.
Which I do personally advocate. I think it helps hold the story together when you
I've done it both ways, and it's interesting both ways. The nice thing about I don't want to use the B word. The nice thing about watching it immersively, watching a lot of it at once, is that you remain aware of things that were distant for the original audience, but as they're going on. So, you know, you're still aware of something that was a month ago for the original viewers, but for you it was just yesterday.
So, it also does make you more cognizant of errors. Continuity problems become a lot more obvious.
It does. I am the writer's best friend because I'm very good at ignoring
that. To be honest, these people were under some major constraints.
They were. The thing about watching it one episode a day is that you really have time to kind of sit with it and think about it and let it just kind of roll around and you come back to it. And you're watching it, for better or worse, the way it was intended to be seen. So I think that's an advantage as well. Do you have a favorite Barnabas moment, even if it's first among equals or one of many? What is a favorite Barnabas moment that stands out for you?
A favorite.
Yeah.
It's not so much a single moment. I'm stretching that a little.
Okay.
The very end of 1840.
Oh.
The end of the courtroom and Andre, that chunk of the show.
Gosh. Yeah. Well, when he goes to look for her.
Yeah.
And they say they've released her and how happy he is to go find her and.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's a favorite in that sort of painful way, but it's one of the moments that really will always stand out for me.
You know, I got a lot of thoughts on that subject and that moment, and, you know, there are several things that, having watched that way too many times, kind of like just watching the end of Honor Majesty's Secret Service over and over again, which I did to an unhealthy degree at one point in my life. The thing that really stands out to me there is after she's dead, two things. One, it's his physical fight with Lamar Trask,
mm-hmm.
because it's terrible. And it's wonderfully terrible, not in a campy way, but in that these are two men who have absolutely no experience with fisticuffs whatsoever. And yet they are put in a position where that's the only thing left to them. And so the slapdash nature of the fight choreography for me works beautifully because it just has this sloppy desperation of incredibly intelligent characters who are driven to this moment. And I love that. And then there's another moment where Stokes really presses Barnabas to go. Suddenly, after just hanging around in 1840, Stokes is like, oh, well, boy, we better go. That staircase might not be there for much longer. And it's ludicrous when you think about it, because, you know, where is Stokes getting this? Where's the staircase going to go? It's right. It's a staircase. It's right there. But, you know, that happens. right as they say, well, we're ready to go bury Angelique. And I think Stokes knows that if Barnabas goes to that graveside, and if he sees her buried, he's never coming back.
That's yeah, he sort of, Stokes is being the friend who's like, man, you don't want to go over there.
Yeah.
Come over here, we're going to have a drink at the bar, you don't want to go over there.
And he can't come out and say that to Barnabas, so he has to make up this nonsense.
It really is a nonsense excuse if you look at it. Like, well, why today and not a week ago then?
And I think probably...
And how do you know that?
I think Barnabas knows what Stokes is doing.
I think he does. He's not stupid.
No, he's not. No, he's not. And he just has to... He has to go back and deal with it. And I remember.
But what a horrible! It's just when you, because obviously we as the audience never see the actual aftermath of this because it immediately goes into parallel time.
Sure.
But just how awful that would be, and I really do wish we would have had a chance to see how it would have played out. Of like. Going back, and
well,
there's...
It's the end of somewhere in time.
They're just going, just carrying on with life, and nobody but Julia and Stokes would know what had happened to him. Not a single person would know.
Did you see Somewhere in Time with Christopher
No.
Reeve? Well, it's a great movie. And basically, he loses someone in a time travel incident and winds up in the present and can't go back, and he just dies of a broken heart. He just sort of sits catatonically... Until he's gone, and I this sounds so ludicrous. I worry about Barnabas. I worry that this is what happened to him. When I did the big viewing of the show, the big immersive viewing in 2012, I was fine emotionally until I got to that moment when Barnabas had to come back to the present, and I remember getting in bed that night. And just sort of lying, thinking about the show and what I had seen that day. And it was the second to last day of the whole shebang that I was doing, where I watched the whole show in 45 days. And second to last day, I get in bed, and I had this weird thought. I thought, well, what is Barnabas doing right now? Which was weird. But you've lived with these people for 45 days, and so it almost exists in real time for you. And I just thought about what his feelings were at that moment and how crushed he was after everything that he went through and that this is what you're given. And it hit me emotionally like very few experiences I've had. And I actually felt like the show was cruel at that moment. And it was overwhelming. It was a terrible moment to have emotionally. It was a very rich moment at the same time.
Yeah, I do, on this subject, before we move off it, I do want to say something.
Yes, please.
About that 1840 moment.
Please, please.
You know this about me, that I am a diehard advocate of Barnabas and Angelique being the real love story.
Well, obviously. Do you even need to be an advocate for the obvious?
Yes, but what I want to say is I have encountered, people who try to say that the end of 1840 is some kind of non sequitur. It happens
ridiculous.
At a left field,
ridiculous.
No one's not coming. They built up to that forever.
Yeah, I agree.
You go way back, the one that sticks in my head, it's around the Cassandra storyline.
Uh-huh.
I think it's around the Cassandra storyline. And there are moments, or after that, and there are moments where, you know, he could do something to her, and he never does. Ever.
There's a reason.
There's some moment along the way where she comes to him and she tells him that she's dying. And his reaction is not glee. It's like shock. He's like dying with this tone of like, that that's not what's supposed to happen.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't ever really act on any of his opportunities to take her down. Ever. Yeah. The one time he does is really a 1795 straight out of the pot.
Yes. Yeah. Well, he does. Well, he kills her at one point.
He does kill her.
In the 1795 flashback back.
Yeah.
Where he
you're
goes
right.
back
he
at night. And he well because she's messed over Vicky. She says she's going to get Vicky out of the noose, and instead she just lets her die. And Barnabas and Ben have just had it, and they take torches to her.
I forgot about that. Yeah, I haven't seen that part of the show in a while. You were correct. He does kill her once. But I mean, again, extenuating circumstances.
I think he knows she's going to come back. It's been a long day. She's going to come back. I just got to get this out of my system.
But I can't agree with people whose read on the show is that this was a total out of left field decision. It's been there the whole time.
You know, even let's say it were a total out of left field decision. You know what? It doesn't matter. Because eventually the narrative of how they made the show, while it's interesting trivia, pales in comparison to the fact that the show is a finished text. And whether it was put together piecemeal and blindfolded and just grabbing things at random, or whether it was some master arc that Dan had in a Straczynski-like manner in his desk, which we know he didn't, but whether either of those things are true, or neither of those things are true, when somebody pulls that thing off the shelf in 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50, 60, whenever, 100 years from now, and if they ignore that making-of story, which really is a tangent compared to the text itself, all they have is a story that ends. And the ending is what defines a show, is what defines a story, is a show that ends with the two of them together. So as far as they're concerned, this whole thing was built going to that moment. And the fact that it wasn't becomes an interesting kind of vaguely trivial conversation, like the Stratfordians versus the Oxfordians, which ultimately, who cares? We have the plays of Shakespeare.
Yeah, I feel like in a way, to apply some literary theory to this,
sure.
I advocate a sort of new criticism approach, mm-hmm. which is the close reading of a text as a self-contained object. Factoring in background information.
So would that be post-structuralist?
It's mid-20th century.
I got it. Good for me, I'm smart.
T.S. Eliot was one of the early promoters of new criticism. It was specifically usually applied to poetry, but it was basically you close read a text as a self-referential. Not actually, even if you know that the author had XYZ happening in his life, you don't count that into your analysis of the work because that's not in the text. Which a lot of people have trouble with new criticism because they say that you can't read a text in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. But with something like Dark Shadows, I actually do strongly advocate taking sort of a new critical approach and not being consciously thinking of the nuts and bolts and the stuff happening offset. I think that changes your experience of it, and it changes how you interact with the text when you put that barrier of knowing that these actors were cramming these lines and that the writers didn't really know where it was going, and knowing that changes your engagement.
And I think it lessens it also.
I do too. So with this text in particular, I advocate trying to divorce it from that background knowledge.
Which, again,
like I said earlier in the conversation, people in 1969 didn't have that knowledge this on TV.
No, they didn't.
That's a very 21st century, internet age kind of thing to have happen, and I don't think the show benefits from it.
I agree. When Wallace and I were doing time together, one of the things I mentioned to him that he asked me to bring up now is looking at Dan's penchant to recycle actors. If that had started earlier and he had taken one of the actors who was on the show or who had been on the show up to April 1967 and had them play Barnabas Collins, how different would the show have been? And so I'm looking at several. Unfortunately, Michael Hage is not one of them. Because I think Frid's very genteel nature is something that is essential to the execution of Barnabas, and putting another actor in the place it just would be strange. So there are two who really stand out to me as possible candidates, or if you had to, and one of them is Mitch Ryan. discuss. What would Mitch Ryan have been like as Barnabas, and what would that have done for the show?
Well, that would have been a very different show. That would have been a very different program.
When Maggie is kidnapped and is held in that house, I would have a very different sense of the danger she was under and the nature of the danger she was under.
Yeah, I think, Mitch Ryan, he was a lot more rugged than Jonathan Frid.
Yes, he was.
He had that more, you believe that Mitch Ryan could be someone who could have been in prison.
Yes.
And gone out and remade himself in the world. You don't get that vibe quite as much off Jonathan Frid.
No.
He's got more of that upper crust refinement, whereas Mitch Ryan is a little more... He has a little bit more of a salt of the earth undertone.
He does. Now,
I actually think he would have come across as far more overtly dangerous and potentially violent.
I feel like that's the Barnabas people keep thinking Barnabas is when they talk about remakes. The one positive that would have come out of Mitch Ryan playing Barnabas is. Good God, can you imagine how much more formidable they would have had to have made Angelique?
Yeah, because Mitch Ryan, he looks like a guy who could take you down in a bar fight.
Sure.
Whereas Jonathan Frid does not quite give off that vibe.
No, he doesn't. And that's what makes his triumph in various fights and his efforts, roaming around Collinwood with a gun and those moments, so endearing.
It's really endearing because you just look at him and you're just like, oh, honey.
Thanks for playing. Thanks for playing. Gosh.
And for effort.
Now go in the closet and hide, and we're going to let maybe Roger take care of this.
Mitch Ryan.
Or Carolyn, or someone.
Whereas with Mitch Ryan, you're like, he's just going to go punch that guy's face in, and that's going to be the end of that.
He will take the bullets out of the gun and hurl them at the bad guy. Okay, so a more complicated one is Dennis Patrick.
Oh.
As Barnabas. Yeah. That's really layered.
That is an interesting one because he is... Yeah, he is neither of the two previously mentioned options. He doesn't have... He's not quite a Jonathan Frid. But he also isn't that kind of rugged, macho Mitch Ryan.
I really think where he would have excelled would have been Barnabas's abilities at social manipulation. Barnabas's ability to get the old house. Barnabas's ability to turn on Willie. Barnabas's ability to go from a gracious smile to Liz to an absolute sneer to Willie Loomis. So, in other words, Jason McGuire.
I was going to say, so basically Jason McGuire.
Yeah,
basically, it would have been Barnabas Collins as played by Jason McGuire.
And I would not have felt as sorry for him dealing with Angelique.
No, I feel like the thing is, Dennis Patrick is a lot less sympathetic.
Maybe, but gosh, I love him as Paul Stoddard.
In a way that I'm going to put a caveat on that. In a way that I very much like and appreciate.
Okay. All right.
Not in a, it's when you say unsympathetic, it instantly makes it seem like you really don't like that character.
Sure.
It's more that there's a little bit more of an inner conflict over whether you want them to succeed.
Yes.
And I think that's what, once Barnabas is sort of over his, evil phase, you don't want him to... You actually honestly never want him to fail, let's be honest. No one ever wants him to get staked in a coffin. When he's evil, you don't really want him.
He's fighting to get his gal back.
I feel like there might be a little more of a threat of... But maybe we do want him to get it staked in the coffin with a different actor.
Oh, I think so.
It would be less of that... Instantly, like, oh no, we definitely don't want that to ever happen. Is with Jonathan Frid. You don't want that.
Yeah.
You almost feel very protective of him very quickly. An actor who's better at playing unsavory characters there would be a little more of that push-pull of, but maybe we would be better off if someone killed you.
Okay, so now we're going to go last thing, and then we got to... Bob's getting ready to close. We gotta hit the trail. I think the most heartbreaking choice, and I'm almost ready to weep just saying the words, Joel Crothers as Barnabas. Oh. It's just instantly heartbreaking.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, that guy talking about Josette or whatever, I'm gone.
Oh, that would be, that's a tug at the heartstrings right there.
You would have the entire family guarding the old house to stop Woodard from going in to stay.
That's
like, no, he's a nice
true.
Guy. Let him kidnap her. She'll be better off. Sam would be fighting for it. Now, Meg.
That's the thing. Nobody, there wouldn't be anyone having the villain or hero debate with Joel Crothers.
No,
everyone would be unified on the hero front.
And the man was a saint. He really,
no,
really
nobody
wins.
Would be able. Nobody would be making the villain argument.
Even as Nathan Forbes, he somehow is a saint. I love him.
He's still endearing and likable as Nathan Forbes.
Yeah.
Who should not, under any circumstances, be seen as endearing or likable?
No. All right, Bob's getting ready to close. I say this: long live Joel Crothers. Long live Jonathan Frid.
I agree. Hear, hear.
So say we all. Have a great night.
You too. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Bye.
Bye.